For nearly 2,000 years, England used only metal as money. In the 17th century, when banknotes and exchequer bills appear, they were not legal tender, not even thought of as money. The American colonies were enjoying an extremely fast-growing economy, probably the fastest growing in the world. This growth required a circulating medium, and the ones the colonies had were not sufficient. There were no gold or silver mines, and no mints. London did not send enough specie for the fast economy. The colonists were forced to use Dutch, Portuguese, and Spanish coins. Spanish pieces of eight were the most common. The people were in such dire need of a circulating medium that for 10 to 20 years after 1640, more people were going back to England than were coming here from England. The lack of circulating medium influenced the colonists to embark on a series of monetary innovations. The Indian chief Pontiac issued notes made of birch bark to obtain supplies he needed while besieging the Fort of Detroit. After the siege, he paid off all his notes and withdrew them. At one time, North Carolina had 17 commodities that were used as legal tender. Virginians and Marylanders paid their bills in tobacco. South Carolinians remitted quick rents and public charges with skins, cheese, tar, whale oil, butter, tallow, corn, wheat, tobacco, pork, and beeswax. At various places and times, other colonists resorted to sugar, rum, molasses, beads, bullets, rice, indigo, and other products as currency. Such practices encouraged colonial governments to bestow legal tender quality upon different media at different times without waiting for royal permission to do so. During the 17th century, New Englanders used wampum. They made wampum their principal measure of ordinary retail trade. In 1637, the government of Massachusetts declared white wampum legal tender for debts under 12 pence at the rate of 4 white beads per penny, and in 1640 it declared blue wampum legal tender at 2 beads per penny. Wampum retained this legal tender status for another 21 years. Massachusetts also designated musket balls legal tender at 4 per penny. John Hall opened and operated a mint in Massachusetts in 1652. He produced what has been referred to as the pine tree shilling. It was called this because most of the coins have the image of a pine tree stamped on one side, although oak and willows were also stamped on some coins. These coins were minted with 67 grains of gold. This is the same measurement as the ancient byzant, the coin that was minted in Byzantium by Constantine in 325 A.D. The Massachusetts Assembly made the coins legal tender, even though the mint was considered treason in England. Hall's Mint stayed in business until 1684 and produced about 1 million pounds sterling worth of coins. This did not relieve the colonists' monetary distress because the coins almost immediately flowed to England and were reminted into English coins. Wool became legal tender for some purposes in Rhode Island, as did rice in South Carolina. So from 1632 to 1692, the colonists went through a period called country pay. This was a period where many agricultural products were declared as money. It was not quite barter because the money values of the produce were fixed by law, much as has been done in ancient Mesopotamia. We have part of a journal that was kept by an educated lady by the name of Madam Knight. She made a trip on horseback from Boston to New York and has enlightened us a little. Because of this journal, we have an idea as to how this system worked. Here is how part of her journal reads. They give a title of merchant to every trader who rates his goods according to the time and species they pay him, such as money, pay, pay as money, and trusting, pay in grain, pork, pay in beef, etc., at the prices set by the general court. Money is pieces of eight, rials, Boston, or Bay shillings, or good hard money, as sometimes silver coin is called. Also, wampum, like Indian beads, which serve as change. Pay as money is a provision aforesaid, one-third cheaper than the assembly set it, and trust as they agree for at the time. When the buyer comes to ask for a commodity, sometimes before the merchant answers that he has it, the merchant asks, "Is your pay ready?" Perhaps the chap replies, "Yes." "What do you pay in?" asks the merchant. The buyer, having answered, then the price is set. As suppose he wants a 6D knife. In pay, it is 12D. In pay as money, it is 8D. And in hard money, it is its own value, or 6D. It seems a very intricate way to trade, and what the Lex Mercatoria had not thought of. You heard me mention the term Lex Mercatoria. This was a Latin term which in English meant merchant's law. A distinct feature of merchant's law was the reliance on merchants on a loyal system developed and administered by them. State and local authorities seldom interfered, but under merchant's law, states took in a large amount of taxes. Not surprisingly, this experimentation gave Americans expansive ideas about the materials proper for money. One Boston essayist, writing in 1740, defined money as any matter, whether metal, wood, leather, glass, horn, paper, fruits, shells, kernels, etc. Any matter which comes as used as a medium of commerce. This is a formulation in sharp contrast to the metal-oriented definitions current in Britain. It was during the course of this experimentation that the British colonists created the first fiat paper monies in the Western world. The colonists were familiar with bills of exchange in foreign transactions, promissory notes in domestic transactions, and letters of credit. These instruments may have planted the idea of using paper as material for currency. Whatever the inspiration, some kind of formal paper medium, it's not exactly sure when it happened, but it was circulating in New England well before 1684. In 1690, Massachusetts issued the first government-sponsored American paper money in the form of 7,000 pounds sterling worth of bills, and they issued them. At first, the paper was not made a legal tender, but everyone accepted it, and they immediately began circulating as money. Massachusetts emitted another 33 pounds sterling in 1691, of which 10,000 pounds sterling was eventually redeemed and burned. And in 1692, the Massachusetts Assembly declared them legal tender for all payments. This money did not flow back to England like the coins did. In Canada, in 1685, French officials cut playing cards in force and endorsed amounts on them. These playing cards circulated until they were paid in 1714 in coins or other money. There was at this time a band of about 500 counterfeiters, and they worked from New Hampshire to North Carolina. North Carolina authorized persons confronting a counterfeiter to kill him if he would not surrender within a certain time. Pennsylvania punished counterfeiters by cutting off both ears on the first offense. More Massachusetts paper appeared in 1702 and later. The colony of South Carolina issued paper money in 1703. New Hampshire, New York, and Connecticut did so in 1709. Rhode Island did it in 1710. North Carolina in 1712, Pennsylvania in 1723, and Maryland in 1733. By 1760, every colony had followed suit. The value of paper bills was stable for a few years after the 1690 Massachusetts emission, but then they began to dwindle. During the first half of the 18th century, the currencies in all four New England colonies performed as poorly as a pessimist might expect. In 1736, Thomas Hutchinson, a leading political figure who later became the colony's last civilian royal governor, reported that Massachusetts notes, initially worth 27 shillings, were then worth only 8. In 1702, 100 pounds sterling could be had for 133 in Massachusetts currency. By 1749, one needed 1,100 in Massachusetts bills to purchase the same amount in the relatively stable British medium. Over a 15-year period, from 1744 to 1759, Rhode Island notes lost more than 80% of their value. Over a much wider stretch of time, from 1720 until 1765, that was the year after Parliament's Currency Act became effective, Massachusetts currency inflated against sterling more than fourfold, all before 1750, and Rhode Island currency more than 12-fold. Gresham's Law holds that bad money drives out good, and Gresham's Law was sovereign in New England. Specie essentially disappeared from daily trade. On the other hand, a pessimist might be pleasantly surprised by the more mixed record in the other colonies. Maryland and the Carolinas experienced significant inflation, but not Virginia, nor did New York, New Jersey, or Pennsylvania. For example, over the 45-year period from 1720 to 1765, by comparison, the United States Consumer Price Index rose 586% in the 45-year period ending in 2007. Professor Paul Studinski and Herman Koos have summed up the colonial experience with paper money in this way. Pennsylvania currency rose only 29% against the pound sterling. The depreciation of colonial paper money has usually been exaggerated. Where the bills were used in moderation and not as substitute for taxes to pay current expenses, and where the banknotes were issued cautiously and subject to rigid redemption, they did not have a bad history. Indeed, in 7 colonies, the experience was favorable, while in the 6 others, it was unfavorable. Amid this mixed record, one unmixed fact stands out. Paper money was popular. People were willing to accept the risk of inflation and the inconvenience of the lack of monetary uniformity over the economic consequences of deflation. As historian Mary Schweitzer observed in Pennsylvania, paper money was virtually an apple pie and motherhood issue throughout the colonial period. Nor were the advocates of paper money all, or even mostly, radical redistributionists or demagogues. Many responsible Americans believed that paper money, when properly secured, was a sensible approach to the colony's need for liquidity. They believed that the colonies needed paper money to prevent the deflation that results when the supply of circulating media does not keep pace with a quickening economy. One paper money advocate was Benjamin Franklin, who, while still a young man, wrote A Modest Inquiry in the Nature and Necessity of a Paper Currency, in which he urged Pennsylvania to adopt a land bank or loan office system. Franklin argued that to a greater extent than in Europe, American assets consisted primarily of illiquid real estate, and to put those assets to work in the daily business of commerce, they could be used to collateralize a circulating medium. Franklin continued to support paper emissions throughout his life. So long as such emissions were secured by valuable assets and remained free of tender laws, which binded those from outside the issuing jurisdiction. While serving in London as Pennsylvania's colonial agent, Franklin published a pamphlet urging repeal of the 1764 Currency Act, which had imposed strict restraints on colonial paper. Franklin's views were shared by many others of great respectability, including Daniel Delaney, a distinguished essayist and lawyer, and several of the king's colonial governors. British imperial authorities and their American allies were unsympathetic to colonial paper currency and made various efforts to control it. For example, in 1749, when the British government shipped 183,000 pounds sterling in specie to Massachusetts to reimburse the colony for war expenses the colonies had had with the Indians, Tommy Hutchinson, the conservative speaker of the colony's House of Representatives, convinced the legislature to dedicate the specie to retire outstanding bills of credit. In 1751, Parliament prohibited the colonies from issuing any further paper bills or bills of credit, or any kind or denomination whatsoever, other than short-term tax anticipation notes and funding for emergencies. Parliament also provided that no paper money in New England should be legal tender. Although three New England colonies somehow managed to issue paper money after 1751, it was better secured and carried no legal tender status. Massachusetts and Connecticut labeled their new issues treasury notes rather than bills of credit. In Massachusetts, they bore interest and were convertible into specie on demand. In Connecticut, they also bore interest. Rhode Island continued to emit bills, but they were convertible into specie within 2 years of issue. In 1764, Parliament adopted an act addressing the colony's paper bills of credit, now known as the Currency Act of 1764. This measure extended the ban on issuance of legal tender paper currency from New England to all American colonies. The immediate effect was significant deflation that eventually fostered considerable colonial resentment. Feelings had been deteriorating for some time and continued to erode as older currencies were retired and the British rejected several substitutes for maintaining liquidity. Moreover, the colonists were frustrated by the British government's fragmentation of responsibility for American policy among Parliament, the Privy Council, the Secretary of State for the Southern Department, and the 16 Lords Commissioners of States and Plantations, what we would call the Board of Trade. One effect of this fragmentation was that the imperial government had difficulty defining the boundaries of the Currency Act. Most of the colonies attempted to cobble together ways of supporting their currencies without legal tender laws. Pennsylvania, for example, issued non-legal tender notes secured by previously issued legal tender notes, but none of these experiments proved wholly satisfactory. Finally, in 1773, Parliament granted to all the colonies a concession it earlier had granted only to New York. It permitted the colonies to issue tax anticipation bills that constituted legal tender only for public obligations, including payments to government land banks. The same year, the British further sought to ease the colonial specie shortage by striking a copper halfpenny for Virginia. By that time, however, it was probably too late to rescue the transatlantic relationship. At the time, there were three kinds of American paper money. One was bills of credit. Another one was paper money bill of credit, and the third was the government paper money bill of credit. Legal writers, as opposed to economic historians, seem almost universally to have made the error of assuming that the constitutional phrase bills of credit was a mere synonym for paper money. In fact, bills of credit constituted only the most important of several categories of American paper currency. The name of bills of credit probably was inspired by private bills of credit, which were instruments executed by an issuer to a potential creditor, informing the potential creditor that if he extended credit to an identified potential debtor, often the issuer's agent, and delivered to the issuer the debtor's written acknowledgement of the debt, then the issuer would hold the creditor harmless. A paper money bill of credit was similar to its private counterpart in that the issuing government gave the instrument to one of its creditors to assure the creditor that if he extended credit to his fellow citizens, which is potential debtors, then he, the creditor, would be held harmless. The government promised to discharge this obligation by future payments or by accepting the bill in lieu of future taxes or other fees. The paper money bill of credit, however, differed from its private party similar in that the public bill was intended to circulate as currency and the bearer presented the same document rather than a separate document executed by the debtor when seeking payment. How a colony labeled its currency did not necessarily control whether that currency was actually a bill of credit. The Treasury notes issued by Connecticut and Massachusetts after mid-century were not legal tender, but they were bills of credit in all but name. Some forms of paper money, on the other hand, were clearly not bills of credit. The Virginia and Maryland tobacco notes, although generally serving as legal tender, were classic warehouse receipts. In contrast, the bills issued by a land bank were not actually bills of credit. Bills of credit represented the government's indebtedness to citizens. Land banks' bills represented citizens' indebtedness to the government. Both bills of credit and other forms of paper money could be secured or unsecured. For instance, Maryland's indented bill of 1733 were collateralized by stock in the Bank of England. Other instruments were backed by commodities such as lumber. A less tangible form of security, if it was security at all, backed the first Massachusetts bill of credit. Those bills entitled the bearer to remit them for payment due at the colonial treasury, most likely for tax payments. Each bill specified its denomination and proclaimed that it shall be in value equal to money and shall be accordingly accepted by the treasurer in all public payments and for any stock at any time in the treasury. Most other early colonial issues, especially those in New England, followed the same general formula. If the issue were legal tender, the phrase "and all others" might be inserted on the bill after the word "treasurer." The terms of repayment of paper money also varied. An emission might promise payment in specie or some other asset on demand, or it might provide for remittance after a date, fixed or variable, or tied to future tax receipts. Some currency bore interest and some did not. Currency, whether or not in the form of bills of credit, might or might not be legal tender. Some was pure fiat money like the modern Federal Reserve notes, promising nothing but stating on its face merely that it was lawful money or shall pass current at a denominated amount. This brings us right up to the Revolutionary War. As Bowdoin said, the whole story of the rebellious colonies is a story which relates more to monetary conventions and principles than to any other subject. Armed revolution erupted in the spring of 1775. The Continental Congress decided to issue bills of credit worth 2 million Spanish mill dollars to finance the cause. There were several reasons for this decision. First, Congress had the power to issue bills of credit, but no authority to raise money through taxation. Second, the states did not pay the full amount of congressional requisitions, but rather competed with Congress for European loans. And third, as noted above, paper money was popular. Congress soon issued more bills of credit. By 1778, Continental issues had grown to $30 million, by 1779 to $150 million, and by 1780 to $240 million. It's expensive to run a war. This was in addition to about $200 million in paper emitted by the states. In 1776, Congress asked the states to make congressional bills legal tender, that is, to force people to take them at face value. Most states complied. Congress was not the only one issuing paper money. The English were counterfeiting the colonies' money big time. On our next program, we'll examine how the English practice of counterfeiting affected the Revolutionary War. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again on our next show.